But first, Barbara Ehrenreich is known as a deep thinker, a social activist, and the author of the influential book Nickel and Dimed. But now Ehrenreich is grappling with something more personal and harder to put into words.
Ehrenreich's new memoir centers on her teenage quest for truth and the experiences that came along with it when she was still a teenager.
The daughter of avowed atheists, she waited until now to try to make sense of what it meant and how what happened to her affected the way she sees her life in the universe. Barbara, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, when did you realize that you needed something inside you, needed to go back and make sense of the experiences that you had when you were a teenager, when you were on this kind of quest to find truth?
Well, I can't say there was an exact point when I decided to turn my part of my attention toward this. But it certainly helped that in 2001, I came across the journal I had kept as a teenager. And I knew it was there, I guess, but I had never looked at it. All these decades had gone by, and it had somehow managed to come with me everywhere I moved. I saw it, and I thought, okay, someday, very soon, I have to go back to this and read it and transcribe it.
And what the journals are a record of several years when you were starting with, I think, when you were 14, and you were on this mission to kind of figure out what life was about. That's kind of a bold mission for a 14-year-old. What made you think you had
to do
that?
Well, I actually started on this mission when I was 12.
So
I didn't start the journal recording my progress or lack thereof until I was 14. But, you know, I think a lot of people have a point, often in childhood or adolescence, where they say, hey, wait a minute, what is this all about? We're born, we live, we die. What does it add up to? I think that's pretty common, right?
And you called it the situation.
Yeah, I began to see it as a distinct situation that human beings were in, And without anybody much talking about it. Perhaps religious people talked about it more, but always, you know, by eliminating the death part, by saying, you know, this is all, we're just fulfilling some plan of a divine being. Now, my parents were atheists. Religion was not a factor in how we saw the world, except insofar as we were occasionally harassed for being atheists. But other than that, it was not something I would turn to.
So here you are, you're 12 when you start this quest for truth, and you're living in this family of atheists, and it's a rough upbringing. It's not like you could just go to your mom and your dad and say, help me figure this thing out. Where did you turn?
No, it was a difficult family. My parents got married too young. My father was originally a copper miner in Butte, Montana. They were, you know, from blue-collar families, and experienced a rather rapid, looking back on it, upward mobility, so that by the time I was 10 or 12, we were beginning to be really middle class. And I think that was all very disorienting, plus a lot of geographical moves. And it certainly didn't help that both parents were alcoholics.
And so where did you go when you started this quest? How did you begin your search?
I didn't know how to do it. I thought, well, where do I look? In the library. Okay, look in library books, first thought. Or maybe it's in another form. Maybe some, you know, piece of music. Maybe some pattern is going to emerge just out of things around me that will reveal what I'm looking for. So mostly I read and read and read.
Right, and you counted things like the number of birds flying by, looking for numerical patterns. And at one point you read the Upanishads and decided you were a Hindu.
I decided I was a Hindu. On the basis of nothing but reading the Upanishads, I didn't know anything about actual Hindu practice or, the pantheon of deities. I knew almost nothing about that. But I was intrigued because it seemed that here were people asking or looking at similar giant issues.
Well, so in one day, you were on one of these forced family excursions going to a horse show, and you had something happen to you that you had never had before, this feeling that you describe of everything being stripped away, everything that had to do with language and meaning, and it was interesting to you to see what was left. Can you describe what happened?
I have since learned that there is a psychiatric term for that. That's called dissociation. And it's usually viewed as a disorder, something wrong. If you suddenly see the world as if this layer of human meanings and words had been stripped away from it. I didn't find it scary. I found it intriguing. I thought, well, maybe this is the real world here that I'm seeing now. But, of course, I didn't talk to anybody about these little episodes. I had the good sense to know that would not be probably well received.
Especially when you were growing up. Yeah, so how often did you have those feelings of dissociation?
I don't have any way of answering that numerically. And the references, even in my journal, are at first very guarded, as if I understood that was something kind of off limits. Not that I expected anybody else to ever read my journal. I suppose I don't know. So I would say they were. This is an odd thing. Much more frequent in sunlight. So the winter was kind of safer territory. In terms of avoiding these dissociative episodes.
Well, what did you make about that? So you've got these data points now of these altered experiences with what we know as reality, and you're searching for truth. So how did you file away those experiences?
No, I didn't know how to put it together. I guess I opened up to the possibility that what we all call reality as humans, and we agree is our shared reality, is maybe not all that there is.
And what about looking back at them now? You had another experience that I want to get to, but all of this you're sort of sifting through the eyes of adults, you know, adulthood and the experience behind you, but looking back now at those experiences of dissociation, what do you think of?
It makes sense to me, psychologically, even physiologically, you might say. It takes a lot of work on our part to perceive the world. You don't just see a desk. You see, certain photons enter on your retina. But there's a long process by which the brain puts together the idea of desk. Now, if you short-circuit that process because you're tired, or as I probably was when it first happened, then you see something very different. And I think this is not an uncommon experience either. But again, where are the numbers?
And you had another experience later on. This was sort of the one that blew the lid off everything you were thinking about and all the experiences you'd had. You were on a road trip with your brother and a guy named Dick who was driving the car. Tell us what happened, would you?
Well, we ended up staying overnight in the car, sleeping in the car, somewhere in the Sierra Nevadas, Lone Pine, California. And when I woke up, and it was still pre-dawn, I got out of the car very quietly, left the other two sleeping, and started walking around these strange streets, probably mainly looking for a restroom. And suddenly this kind of, I don't know what the word would be, epiphany, revelation, took place. And I want to say right away this has nothing to do with hallucinations, nothing to do with any drugs, there were no visions. I saw no faces, heard no voices. But the world seemed to come to life. It seemed to, like, flame into life. And I was, the feelings that went with this were very powerful. You could say ecstasy, but you have to also add an element of almost terror at the magnitude of what was going on. So this is the kind of thing I later realized that other people, if it happened to many people, they would say that was God.
And what did you
but
say?
That didn't occur to me.
What did you say to yourself after this thing, this time when everything flamed to life and you talk about standing in storefronts and watching teacups that are sort of on fire? How did you process that without God?
Imagine a universe without God, for a start. I mean, where does this idea come from, that there would be this, you know, giant, a supernatural being? That was not in my mental lexicon. I thought there were two possibilities, and it took me a while to think clearly enough. I mean, it took me really several months before I could think clearly enough to even distinguish the possibilities. One, which would be the, quote, realistic way of seeing it, was that there was some kind of mental breakdown, temporary mental breakdown. It had to do with being overtired and probably a little hypoglycemic, who knows, and that, you know, it had no other significance at all. But the second possibility, the strange one, which I guess intersects with your question about God, is that it had been an encounter with something, some being, some other mind, utterly strange to me, or probably to unrelated to anything human.
Well, we'll talk more about that and find out how you've dealt with that and what you thought in the years after. As we talk with Barbara Ehrenreich, the best-selling author of Nickel and Dimed, she has a new memoir out. It's called Living with a Wild God, a Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything.
And we welcome your calls now. If you have a question for Barbara Ehrenreich about her experience, or if you've had a similar moment, this epiphany, if you'd like to call it that, and you see it as part of our homework here on Earth to figure out why we're here. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Barbara Ehrenreich now, the best-selling author of Nickel and Dimed. Now Barbara has a new memoir out. It's called Living with a Wild God, a Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything.
She tells her story about her search for truth starting around age 12, epiphanies she encountered along the way. And we want to hear from you. Is it our job to ask these questions, to seek out why we're here, what we're meant to be doing? And have you had a moment, a transformative moment that changed the way you look at the universe you live in? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Barbara, we were just talking about this experience you had. If you liked the term, I would call it a mystical experience, but you were reluctant to call it that, where the world sort of flamed to life and you felt a kind of ecstasy mixed with terror. And you write that you should have died then, that that moment was kind of the ultimate experience of reality. How did it shape your life?
It's hard to say. The reason I felt I should have died was I felt I knew what I had been looking for. I now had a glimpse of it. But I couldn't put it into words. And so what did I really know? So I was stuck. I didn't quite know why I was alive anymore, or, you know, I know it's no longer clear about my mission. I did go on to college, which was sort of life-saving. Very life-saving, in that I threw my intellect into science. I said, well, this is what I'm going to do now. I'm going to try to reconstruct the world, the truth about everything, you know, starting with the subatomic particles or, you know, and building on from there.
I want to go to our callers now. We've got some folks waiting to talk with you. And let's go to Don joining us first in Norwalk. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is an enjoyable conversation. I just, I'm reminded on several points from, you know, the things Barb was saying there. And one of them is the disassociated part is similar in some ways, although maybe more positive, to Sartre's Nausea, the book Nausea.
Oh, yes.
But
yes.
I have to say, you know, I've, you know, gone through some stuff like this, too. I mean, I'm 65 years old and was considered myself a hippie back in the 60s and all this stuff. And again, non-drug. I mean, you just think about this stuff hard enough, long enough, and I think these things happen to you.
Uh-huh.
But what happened to me was sort of like G.K. Chesterton talks about a guy that leaves from England sailing to find undiscovered lands and by mistake ends up back in England and thinks it's some different place. And what I'm getting at is I ended up back in Catholicism because uh-huh. if you go long enough through a whole variety of perspectives, you sort of rediscover things. And the image that comes to me sometimes is we all are trying to figure this stuff out. It's like we're all pressed up against this great wall that we're like feeling our hands along, trying to find the entrance to the other side. And right next to us, there's this huge door with neon signs flashing on and off that say entrance. And to me, that's kind of what Catholicism is. And not discounting any of the mystical and ecstatic states that Barbara talks about. I mean, it's all included. So anyway, I guess there's a lot of routes in there, but that's what happened to me anyway.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Don.
Interesting. You know, one sort of, I did research. This is it's a memoir. That's the action and the narrative comes from my life. But I did research, too, and one of the things I did, which was a very strange thing for an atheist to do, was read some of the Christian mystics. These are all Catholics in the cases I read, very devout people. But there were, I could find similarities in what they described as their mystic experiences. If I took out the word God, if I took out the idea that there was a benign person-like being somewhere, then I felt a real connection.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And I want to ask you a little about where you are now. The book of your the title of your book is called, the subtitle, you know, Living with a Wild God, a Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. Do you still consider yourself an atheist, having gone through this experience, having read the mystics and maybe seen similarities?
Oh,
in
yes.
Experience?
I think actually the test of anybody, whether somebody is a true atheist, is that they should go through an experience like this and see if they come out as an atheist. You know, if you're tempted to say, oh, that must be God, trying to contact me or something, then all right, that's over. But I have no sign in that direction. There was no face to this. There was nothing familiar in a human way.
So what is the force in the universe, then, that you write about that might, you think, be coming for us?
Well, what I end up speculating about in the book is the possibility that there are other conscious beings in the universe that are at this point not easily detectable to us, but that we can, you know, that we may sometimes be in contact with. Now, I have to immediately say I am not talking about some particular type of spirits, but just, you know, there are things that science has ignored because it is so hard, has been so hard for science to acknowledge the existence of non-human consciousness, of even, you know, the beings around us. Science more or less absolutely maintained until a couple of decades ago that non-human animals, for example, have no consciousness, awareness, feelings, etc. Well, we're learning a lot more about that. In fact, weirdly enough, the discussion has moved on to plants. But the tendency of science built in to some of the, you know, notion, Descartes, Cartesian notions of science is that everything in the world is dead. And with, it's very shocking to find that there may be other beings.
Well, Barbara, it's a fascinating journey. Thank you for sharing it with us and for talking today.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been talking to Barbara Ehrenreich, the best-selling author of Nickel and Dime, talking about her new memoir called Living with a Wild God, a non-believer search for the truth about everything.